Coming up on Tech Nation, there's so much information swirling all around us. So what's true and what isn't? And what is it about being human that keeps us believing just about anything, no matter what? I speak with Dr. Daniel Levitin about his book, A Field Guide to Lies, Critical Thinking in the Information Age. Then on Biotech Nation, the second installment of our two-part series on women in biotech venture capital. Today it's Wendy Hutton, Nita Jelson, and Julie Papanek, all from Canaan Partners. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 minutes.
It came to the public's attention when the FBI filed court documents demanding that Apple help it hack into the iPhone of one of the perpetrators of the December 2015 San Bernardino mass shooting. Apple refused for weeks on end, and then suddenly, the FBI didn't care anymore. It had broken in all on its own, retrieved whatever data was there, and dropped its case. Then there's the turnaround. Apple wanted to know how the FBI did it, so they could patch holes in their security, so the next time, maybe the FBI wouldn't be so lucky. Of course, the FBI declined to say. If you check the internet, or your closest security expert, or self-appointed expert, you'll get all kinds of answers to the question, how did the FBI do it? There was a security consulting company. They used Edward Snowden's NAND mirroring technique. They guessed right about the password, because if they didn't, after 10 tries, the data would be gone forever. Some people say all of the above, while others say none of the above. There's no legal requirement for the FBI to tell Apple anything at all. And when mum's the word, speculation runs at hyperspeed. Legal experts tell us that if the data is used in open court, the FBI would have to reveal how it obtained the data. But no one seems to realize that it may have been easier than even any of the speculation. As in, the FBI has been working on this for weeks, and they have all sorts of other data from the person who owned the phone. Information is data in context, and context is everything in cases like these. If you had all my computer data and my email and my text messages and my passwords to everything else, you'd have a major head start for breaking it down on my phone. Was this iPhone the only password-protected piece of technology its owner had? Could he possibly have suspected that this would be the sticking point in the aftermath of his horrific deed? And then there's the practicality of it. Either you choose a PIN code that you can easily remember, or you use a completely unfamiliar one, one which you would write down somewhere. Somehow, you need a reference, or your phone would freeze up on you and be unusable. The focus in the media has been on an isolated iPhone, as if it were without context. Did you see The Imitation Game with Benedict Cumberbatch? The Turing crowd broke the German Enigma code because they had context. Still, I would hope that the FBI isn't being passive-aggressive here. I mean, I know that Apple didn't cooperate, but when the FBI lawsuit hit, the iPhone reputation as a secure device rose, and with the prospect that it could be hacked, well, its reputation withers, or rather vaguely. Who knows how vulnerable it is? Since the iPhone in question was an older model, Apple can announce that it's already fixed it. But with the FBI being tight-lipped, the question floats in the air. And for the FBI, it has its own mission. And you never know when another iPhone of the same ilk might fall into its hands, and the same exercise begins again. For Apple and the FBI, who's the good guy and who's the bad guy changes with the news cycle. And it's not over yet. This is truly a tale for our time. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Five Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, a field guide to lies. In this age of information, how do we spot what is and isn't true? Daniel Levitin joins me with help on what to believe and what not to. Then on Biotech Nation, the second installment of our two-part series on women in biotech venture capital. I speak with Wendy Hutton, Nina Shelson, and Julie Papanek, all from Canaan Partners. Daniel Levitin's latest book is A Field Guide to Lies. I asked him, in this information age that we live in, we've got big data, we've got big data analytics. Do we also have big lies?
Well, I guess we do. People are getting away with bigger and bigger lies, it seems. And I think what I'm mostly interested in is that there's more and more false information than ever before, that misinformation and pseudoscience seem to be proliferating like there's no tomorrow. And I think the problem with that is that misinformation is promiscuous. It just ends up in all different kinds of places.
You don't know where it's been. You don't know where it's going. Don't touch it.
Exactly. And you don't know who it's going to be with next.
Exactly. Besides talking about how does the misinformation get formed and its characteristics, you're also very committed to telling people how you can figure it out. That's a whole different premise.
You know, I wrote this book as a very practical guide. There's not any theory in there, nothing about what the brain's doing when this goes on. It's just these are the steps to follow if you're above the age of 12 or so and you want to know how to make sense out of things. It's what we would classically call critical thinking that most of us haven't been trained to do. Lawyers, scientists, journalists are trained to do it. The rest of us are often left at the mercy of people who are really good at spinning a story or taking advantage of us.
Well, it is interesting. There's some simple things here, and I know some people don't even like arithmetic, but you say elementary school arithmetic. Add up all the percentages on the pie chart. They're supposed to equal 100.
Right. Very simple, right? I'm not talking multivariate calculus here, not even algebra. Just, yeah.
Add them up. Fox News got it wrong in your example.
Yeah, they published this pie chart of who was supporting whom in the Romney presidential election. And you look at the numbers and they add up to way more than 100%. Now, I can imagine how that happened. It might be they asked people in a poll, who do you support? And people were allowed to give more than one name. But then don't make a pie chart. It's nonsensical.
Yeah. Sounds like one of those terrible pies that I would make. I'll have to take a look at that more closely. And also, you do dip into statistics. I laughed out loud when I read your line, on average, humans have one testicle. It's like, oh yeah, I see how you got that.
Well, there's a problem with averages, isn't there? An average is a distortion of reality because you're taking a whole bunch of data points, anywhere from a few to dozens to millions, and you're trying to summarize them with a single number, right? That can be useful, but it can also lead to a distortion. I think people need to know. The next time you see an average, ask yourself, is it reasonable to take an average of this thing? Or could it be that we're combining apples and oranges or testicles and ovaries in this case, right? I mean, yes, on average, humans have one testicle. But that's not really a well-formed way to summarize the human race.
In a real sense, even with the simple statistics, one of the things you're asking is, first of all, look at the data. What is the data that they're looking at? And what kinds of things about that data are important to see?
Exactly. And I mean, there are some fundamental things you can ask, such as, are we comparing apples and oranges? Is it a fair comparison, especially when we're dealing with averages? Just to take another example, suppose you're a salesperson or, you know, you're a real estate agent or you're a stockbroker, and you hear that there's a room over here. And in that room, the average wealth of people in the room is $5 billion each. Now you're thinking, oh, I got to get in there. But what if the room has...
My peeps to sell things to.
Right. What if the room has Warren Buffett and 19 homeless people? Not all homeless people are poor, of course. Again, you don't want to make any assumptions or jump to conclusions. But let's say that this particular group of 19 homeless people have a net worth of zero. And you got Warren Buffett, who knows what his net worth is. The average wealth in that room is very high, but I'm not sure that's a meaningful summary. You're comparing two different groups. It'd be like telling me the average height of a room full of NBA players and five-year-olds. The average would be a number that doesn't actually exist in the room.
I find it's really important when people realize they can't count something or they can't touch something. And so they kind of, they accept the number. And just the idea of what would the minimum be if we worked it out and what would the maximum be? I mean, that's sort of your bounds, your bounding thing. And you gave some examples. One example, if you took the absolute most conservative minimum, it was way off. You can do some arithmetic on your own that actually give you a sense about whether or not it works.
Yeah, so I call this creating boundary conditions, right? So you may not know what the actual number is, but in a number of domains, you may have a guess for what a reasonable minimum or maximum is. Here's one, a favorite example of mine. Somebody told me that they heard that there were 10 billion people in the world without internet. Now, to be honest with you.
10 billion.
That's right. 10 billion people lack internet.
So nobody has internet.
But how do you know that? Now, I don't keep up with the world population, really. You could. I mean, there's a website that ticks off a count, and it's reasonably accurate. The last time I looked, there were 7 billion people in the world. Maybe it's gone up to 8 billion. And if I really haven't been paying attention, maybe it's gone up to 9. But there aren't even 10 billion people in the world. You know, what's an upper and a lower bound for how many people lack internet? Well, certainly there have to be a few hundred million people who have it in the world. The population of the United States is a few hundred million, and there are other countries that have it. So that's a kind of lower bound. And the upper bound, well, it has to be, you know, somewhere near the population of the world, which is 7 or 8 billion.
So this number comes out of nowhere. Yeah.
Somebody misheard it or misunderstood it or, you know, misread it. Who knows? But yeah, we can do that with a lot of things. If somebody tells you, I've got a box that's about this big, it's about 1 cubic foot and it weighs 600 pounds. That just seems implausible. I mean, I could imagine an empty box might only weigh a few ounces, but a box full of lead, I mean, I know this because I have a weight machine at home, and I know that I've got these weights that are made out of lead, and lead is very, very heavy, but it's not 600 pounds in 1 cubic foot.
You call this plausibility.
Yeah.
And there's no, like, you can't open a book on plausibility and say, well, look at us in the chart here. It's like a lot of this depends on what you know about what the world is like.
And we can inform ourselves now instantly. I mean, if you want to know the world population, you can get the answer in half a second.
Look at your phone.
Yeah.
It's right out there. And that brings me to some of the different kinds of information that is available and sort of understanding what it means. I mean, you do have a section on autism and autism spectrum disorder. I remember when Jenny McCarthy was advocating that autism was caused by vaccines based on a completely debunked study, scientific study. And whenever she was asked, well, what is your degree? What is your background in this? She would say she went to the
University of Google.
Yeah. what could be on Google and what couldn't be on Google? What is it about Google? How do you validate a fact?
Well, I have a lot to say about this. In fact, right before you and I got together, I was meeting with a friend of mine named John Pettis, who's starting a website called Fiskit, F like Frank, I S like Sierra, K, fiskit.com. And the idea is that they take articles such as the Jenny McCarthy article, and people are allowed to go in sentence by sentence and flag it. Is this true? Is this untrue? Is this a straw man argument? Is this a fallacy that's being generated? And in fact, the Jenny McCarthy article has been picked apart by
It's all red.
Well, it's 26 thoughtful people, not getting emotional about it, but and not using red ink, which is an emotional color, I suppose. But, you know, they're just telling you this isn't true or this is self-contradictory. And, you know, there are a couple of people who are in favor of her arguments, but they tell you where in the argument they find truth. You asked the question, what can we do with Google? You know, certainly we could talk about the autism MMR link. There's a little known feature of Google that you and I talked about last time I was here, and it's Scholar. If you go to scholar.google.com, it returns primarily peer-reviewed articles on a question. So if you enter MMR or vaccine and autism into Google proper, you get all kinds of stuff. And included in the facts, you get some pseudo-facts. Included with the science, you get the pseudoscience. You get people who know what they're talking about and people who have no qualifications at all. You go to scholar.google and you're going to, by and large, get what the peer review that is validated medical and scientific community has to say about it. And that's a huge leg up and a huge time saver. And I'll just come out and say it. This may be unpopular in some quarters, but there's no scientific evidence for a link. The one study that showed a link between the vaccines and autism has been thoroughly discredited. The guy, Andrew Wakefield, has lost his license. He admitted to fabricating data. I mean, the whole thing has persisted, as some conspiracy theories do, in flying in the face of rationality. And here, you see, there's no math is required, right? I mean, it's just looking at the facts and having an open mind.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Daniel Levitin. You likely know him from his earlier books, including The Organized Mind and This Is Your Brain on Music. He's the Dean of Social Sciences and the College of Arts and Humanities at the Minerva Schools at KGI, and a Distinguished Faculty Fellow at the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley. He's here today with a field guide to lies, critical thinking in the information age. So we're talking about facts, facts that most people link to, and that's what you see on your first page or two. They're the highest ones. It's almost like not fact by evidence, but fact by agreement. And many times they're correct, but they aren't necessarily correct. Another source that we believe in with great fervor are TED Talks. And you point out that not all TED Talks are equal.
I'm trying to give people a really practical guide here, specific things you can do when you encounter information. So if you go and you look into it, and it doesn't take more than 30 seconds, you'll find that there are 5,000 different TED-branded talks, but only two of them are curated and official talks of the TED organization. They're the standard TED conference, just called TED, and then there's TED Global, which is done out of London. And those are fact-checked scrupulously, as much as a New York Times or NPR story would be. They go through an editing process with professionals, and they're footnoted and, you know, very rigorous standards. The others don't necessarily hew to those standards. So if you're looking at TED or TED Global, you can pretty much rely on what's being said, that people, a team of professionals have gone to vet it. That's not necessarily true with the others.
Well, speaking of checking data, you write, we've created more human-made information in the last 5 years than all human history before them. What are your sources on that?
I gave a talk at Google, and I talked to some Google engineers, and they said this to me. And then I, shortly after that, was at Microsoft and spoke to an executive at Cisco, and they corroborated that, you know, by their best estimates, that's the case. And it's based on the amount of data that's currently being stored. But, you know, when I say we've created more data, that includes scientific discoveries, certainly. It includes the photos we're getting back from Mars and Jupiter. It includes your health records and my health records.
And it includes all those photos and videos you took on your iPhone.
Yes, yes.
Which is a lot more than you did forever, yeah. It seems.
Yeah.
This also points up to, I mean, it's like, oh, well, yes, these kind of experts here, they'd know. These kind of experts here, they'd know. Let's talk about experts because, you know, we have sort of running commentaries by experts on all these channels that point at each other or they just don't agree. How do you validate an expert?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So I do believe that some people are more expert than others. It doesn't make them right about everything, though. It only makes them more likely to be right and then only more likely to be right in their area of expertise. So a pediatrician on the stand in a courtroom testifying about epidemiology is probably out of his or her element. A cognitive scientist like myself talking about economics, probably not a good source for that. Don't ask me any economics questions. I hope they won't be on the test today. I mean, I know a little, but I know better than to talk out of my own area of expertise. Unfortunately, a lot of experts don't know better, or they feel that they should weigh in. And this is where you run into trouble. One of the co-inventors of the transistor, William Shockley, Nobel Prize winner in physics, held these terribly racist beliefs that one particular class of Americans were genetically inferior and intellectually inferior. And people thought, apparently, well, he's a Nobel Prize winner. He must be really smart. He must know a bunch of stuff. And yeah, he did know a bunch of stuff, but not about genetics or intelligence testing or anything like that.
I encounter the same thing. I have people come on. We vetted them for what they're talking about, what they're going to be talking about. And then all of a sudden they want to talk about something else. And I say, I'm sorry, but we can't have you talk about that on air. I mean, go ahead and talk about it. It's not going to make it to air. Yeah. Well, why not? It's like, because that's not your area of expertise. And they're really shocked. And yet these are very sophisticated people. You would say, oh, you're very accomplished and you've got a lot of background. And they don't seem to get that they can't talk about things for which they don't have credentials.
Yeah, it's a funny thing. I think all of us have the tendency to adopt a kind of halo effect bias, where if somebody is really good in one area, we think that the halo extends to others. In my own case, I never think that I'm the smartest person in the room, and I'm usually right about that. And so,
and you're proud of that.
Yeah. I'm usually the dumbest person in the room, but I happen to know some things, and I know what I know, and I know what I don't know. And I'm lucky in that way, but I think that, you know, all of us could benefit from realizing that we don't know as much as we think we do. And I think that's a general rule, and it applies to a lot of people. You and I are both educators, and people ask me, they say, well, you train graduate students. What does that involve? And I joke that really what it is I just wait until they come to me. They start out thinking they know everything. And after they've worked in the lab for 3 or 4 or 5 years, at some point when they come to me and they say, boy, I don't know anything. I say, okay, you're ready for the PhD then.
We can work with you.
Right.
And I can work with that. I tell students who are new graduate students who are saying, well, what about this and what about that? And I go, oh, I forgot to tell you. The difference between graduate school and undergraduate school is we have the same basic assignments, but in graduate school, we don't tell you how to do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You got to figure out how to do it. And there are many ways to do it.
Yeah.
Oh, wait a minute. What am I paying for? It's
right.
Like, not my problem.
Right.
Really not my problem. And yet, getting back to this orientation of the halo effect and, you know, the confidence of what we do know, which we want to rely on, I was surprised to learn that no matter what, if you actually believe in something, even when you're presented with irrefutable evidence, you will continue to believe it anyway.
This is called belief perseverance. It's one of the many biases that we in the cognitive neuroscience field have identified as a foible of the brain. information comes in, you form an opinion about it. When that information is later discredited, it's very hard to shake that original opinion. You know, I think that confidence and humility actually go hand in hand in making a critical thinker. You have to be confident in the method by which information can be vetted. And you have to have a certain amount of confidence in what you know. But as I say, it has to go hand in hand with the humility that the story might change, you might have been wrong, some new information may come in. And this is really the bedrock of science and medicine, is that new information is coming in all the time, and we have to be open-minded enough and humble enough to change our minds. You know, I don't want to be political about this, but we are in a political season. The book was designed to come out at the height of the political rhetoric of a presidential campaign. I think that, and now I'm speaking not as an expert, it's just my personal opinion and observation, that in this election, it seems that a substantial number of Americans decided quite some time ago who they were going to support and are no longer willing to listen to information that goes counter to the candidate that they favor, nor do they want to hear any good information about the candidate they oppose. They've become closed-minded. And I think that that stifles the democratic process.
Now, much of your book is just about being human. It's always in the context of, hey, you know, we're humans. And I keep going back to the early humans, our ancestors. Probably we're related. That's kind of what everybody's telling us, you know. Back then, they didn't have a lot of information going on. Those brains that developed, they weren't presented with all this information, all these things changing around them constantly.
And it would have been a good strategy evolutionarily for our ancestors to learn something and then be done with it, right? You learn that this is where the well is. That's where the water comes from. You can get on to the next thing. You learn.
This is where the danger is. Don't go there. You don't want to have to keep relearning that.
Right. And we were dealing with a vastly simpler social world. Hunter-gatherer tribes that are, you know, still around give us a window into this. Pre-literate cultures I'm talking about. They tend to have living groups of about 150 people, more or less. And so the people that you knew...
You really knew.
Yeah, and you knew them your whole life. And yeah, that person's a little crazy and this person's a little cranky and this person's generous. She gives everything away. When we gather the food, she's the first to distribute it. And, you know, you learn something and the learning could stick for a long time.
I've been speaking with Daniel Levitin, the author of A Field Guide to Lies, Critical Thinking in the Information Age. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are available at iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show, the second installment of our two-part series on women in biotech venture capital. I'll speak with Canaan partners Wendy Hutton, Nina Shelson, and Julie Papanek. Stay with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm speaking with Daniel Levitin, the author of A Field Guide to Lies, Critical Thinking in the Information Age. So there are a gazillion examples, and I'm like trying to figure out which ones to figure out. And I just thought this was a good one. When you're looking at information coming in, you're saying, well, let's see, let's size this up. You look for the existence of a control group and an appropriate control group. Let's discuss that. I think we can get that done.
Yeah, so my colleague at Minerva, Stephen Coslin, the dean of the faculty, tells this story about he ran into somebody at a party, and he had quoted some statistic that if you learn to read at a young age, you have a better chance of succeeding in life. And this person said, oh, well, I didn't learn to read until I was the last person in my classroom to learn to read. And it didn't hold me back. Look at this great career I've had. Well, there's what we call a missing control group or a missing comparison condition. You don't know how much more successful this person would have been if she had learned to read early. And this missing control group comes up in various guises, often in medical practice. So we try an intervention with somebody, but if you don't compare it to something else, how do you know whether it's better than doing nothing or doing better than the standard treatment? So next time you read a report that says we gave people this pill or we put people on this exercise regimen, ask yourself, were there other people doing something that's comparable? Were they interacting with professionals that made them feel as though they were part of something that was going on and they weren't just being forgotten?
Were you in the group where we gave you the diet and we gave you lots of professional help and we made sure you had all of this exercise? Or were you in the couch potato group where we delivered a pizza an hour, nothing to do? And it's like it's more than the calories. It's more than doing that. There's a major differential that there's something wrong with the control group. Or in the worst case, there is no control group.
Right.
This is sort of a higher level thinking about the information coming at us that I don't think we're used to.
Well, no, it's one of the reasons I put it in the book, because we're not used to it. And it's one of the reasons I put it at the end of the book, because I want to build on the foundation of getting in the habit, having the mindset of questioning. You know, I'll tell you an interesting story. When I was born, we were living in Daly City in the Westlake area in the late 50s. And this was very much a working class neighborhood. Most people there hadn't gone to college. And then when I was older, we moved out to the East Bay, to Moraga, which is a suburb where more people had gone to college. And I've been back to visit both places. And one of the interesting things about Daly City, which is still working class and not a lot of college graduates, is that the people there that I've seen tend not to ask questions about things they encounter. They take headlines at face value or a government announcement. I mean, sure, there are people who are suspicious of the man. But I mean, as a general rule, they figure that the information they encounter is true or has been vetted. There's a much greater tendency in San Francisco, in the city, in the suburbs of the East Bay and Marin and the peninsula, the ones where there are more college-educated people, much greater tendency to question authority, to question facts, and to be critical thinkers, critical consumers of information. And I think that that correlates with the increased income of families in those two communities. That it's the people who are willing to question who find themselves in positions of being able to make more money.
And do we know that's linked?
I don't. It's just an observation. It's not an experiment.
You get me all messed up now. Now that I've read this book, it's like, where did you get that information?
Right.
Where
Fair
did
enough.
You know? And maybe it's just that section entitled "When Reporters Lead Us Astray." Let's talk about that. When does the media and people really lend more weight to what they hear from the media, despite what they say about it? How does the media lead us astray?
Well, a funny thing happened on the way to the 21st century. It used to be we had very few news channels. I mean, you'd watch Huntley Brinkley or Dan Rather on television.
Walter Cronkite said it. It was true.
Yeah, that's right. There were few channels of radio and television. There were few newspapers. And pretty much knew that if you read it in a supermarket tabloid, it might be true, but it wasn't as likely as if you read it in, say, the New York Times or the Washington Post. There's a very clear hierarchy of information sources. There still is, by the way. But the funny thing that happened is that some people figured out that there was great entertainment value in taking a biased and cherry-picking view of the news, and that that entertainment value could be translated into big bucks. If you could inflame people, be emotional, you could attract advertisers and an audience. And the lines between journalism and infotainment have become blurred. That's not necessarily a bad thing, as long as we know the difference.
Now, give us an example of something that's a little misleading.
None comes to mind right now. Do you have an example?
Well, you know, one example that I might think of that is not the media per se, but the media reporting what either candidate says. PolitiFact went through and analyzed truths, half false of both candidates. And neither one actually came out very well. One came out a lot worse than the other. So the media is correctly reporting what they're saying, but what they're saying may not be exactly true. What do you do with that if you're the media? What do you do with that if you're a consumer of the media?
Well, this is a thorny question. So I applaud sites like PolitiFact and other fact-checking sites. That's journalists doing their job. It really isn't my job. I don't have the time. Nobody does, nor the skills nor resources to check every statement made by a candidate, not just the presidential candidates, but state assembly, city council. You know, the fact-checking sites do that for us. Journalists are supposed to do it for us. And I think that the journalistic community does a pretty good job, but you're right. Some journalists simply report what's said. Some journalists will simply run with a press release without asking any follow-up questions. In my scientific work, there have been several cases where I published a paper and my university sent out a press release and it would turn up in a newspaper as it was written without anybody interviewing me. What I admire about the New York Times, as just one example, is that in their science section, the Tuesday science section in particular, if they're reporting on a scientific finding, they'll go out of their way to find a scientist who disagrees with the finding. And they'll ask that person to weigh in. They try to give you a balanced view. They try to poke holes in it. That's the way it's supposed to work. And it still falls to all of us. I believe that each of us has the responsibility, before believing something, to take a moment and think about whether it's plausible, whether it's rational to believe it, and what arguments we might not be hearing. What might the other side say? And when journalism really works, it's asking that question for us of experts. Because of the rapidity of the news cycle and the sheer amount of stuff that's coming out, journalists don't always have time to do that, and then it falls to us.
Well, Daniel, always a pleasure. Please come back, whether I invite you or not. How's that?
Thank you very much.
My guest today is Daniel Levitin. The book is A Field Guide to Lies, Critical Thinking in the Information Age. It's published by Dutton. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. The world we know is changing. Welcome to Biotech Nation. Today on Biotech Nation, the second in a two-part series on women in biotech venture capital. We'll hear from three venture capitalists, all from Canaan Partners, headquartered on VC-intensive Sand Hill Road in Menlo Park, California. I'm speaking with General Partner Wendy Hutton, General Partner Nita Shelson, and Principal Julie Papanek. Well, ladies, welcome to Biotech Nation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
I have to say that I know very well some female venture capitalists in this area. I was totally shocked to realize that not only were you three venture capitalists in the healthcare area, you're all working for the same company. How could that be? You take up a big percentage of what's going on in the healthcare investment field.
Well, Canaan has a long-term history of promoting women within, and we've had three general partners out of the 10 investment professionals in the firm. And at our in our healthcare portion of our practice, 50% of our investment professionals are women. This goes back now from a time when we built the firm, probably the year 2000. So this is not a new phenomenon for Canaan.
Now, Wendy, you've been a venture capitalist the longest?
Sure. My experience spans back 23 years. I was a partner at Mayfield Fund in the 90s. When I did join that firm, I was the first investment professional in the firm that was female. So I've seen a big change in the industry.
Your background to get here, Wendy, to be a venture capitalist, are you in science? Are you in finance? How would you describe it?
Well, a little bit of all. I had a scientific undergraduate degree, but I spent 7 years on the entrepreneurial side, actually working for venture-backed companies, both in med tech and in biopharm for 7 years. And I was in business development and marketing, bringing new technologies to the market.
Now, that's similar to your experience, is it not, Nina?
Somewhat. I became a bit of an accidental tourist into the finance side of healthcare. I also had a science undergrad and thought I would be med school bound and began my career in health policy at the Kaiser Family Foundation. And I sort of like to joke I didn't get very far in my career because that job was on Sand Hill Road, about two blocks from where I am now with Canaan.
We have nonprofit like a stone's throw from where all the venture capital funds are.
Well, they support their endowment by leasing space to the venture capitalists. So it's a very virtuous economy on real estate. And then from the Kaiser Foundation, I went to work for a healthcare hedge fund, which is where I got to see a different lens on the biotech industry and the healthcare industry from a finance and a capital side, and saw an incredible opportunity to work with entrepreneurs and to do company building and transition to get earlier and earlier, ultimately coming into venture capital. And while I'm really new to Canaan, I've only been here about 9 months. I spent 13 years with another venture firm across the street. So I've been doing venture for 14 years now.
And Julie, you're the newest to the crowd.
Yes, I am.
Now tell us your background.
So I have been in drug development since I actually joined the workforce. And so I started my career at Genentech here in the Bay Area, mainly working on oncology products, so new cancer therapies. And after going to business school, I was lucky enough to run into Wendy, who was hiring. And it was a bit of a serendipitous meeting. But I actually met Nina before I joined Canaan as well, who had given me career advice. So I was really fortunate both to have Wendy and Nina as mentors pretty early in my career.
Now, you've got 8 members on your healthcare team here. Half of them are women, so we're missing one. She's not here today. So
Colleen, our rock star PhD from Yale.
Yeah, she's busy doing something else.
Holding down the fort in Connecticut.
Somebody's got to hold down the fort at Canaan. So my own experience is that there are times when I'm in groups, I'm the only woman. It's like, oh, when is this going to stop? And then now it's not unusual to be a woman. Has that changed anything? Wendy, I should probably direct that to you.
So we've seen a major shift, both at the venture capital level and the partnership level across the industry. It's very gratifying. Nina hosted a dinner recently for venture capitalists, and we had over 100 female VCs in the room, which was really quite stunning for where we've come over the last couple decades. Secondly, I think what we see now at the C-suite level in the biopharm industry is really a change. You know, people like Julie and Colleen with just tremendous educations and backgrounds in drug development who are really now starting to be at the peak of their careers. So, in fact, we see women filling chief medical officer roles and CEO roles at a pace that we have not seen previously. It's very gratifying to see the change in the last 10 years.
My experience is that when you finally get to a mix of, it could be a mix of male and female, it could be any diversity, whether it is we're talking race, we're talking scientists and non-scientists, anytime you start mixing, you have to get to sort of a threshold. And once you get to that mysterious threshold past that, then you come into balance and it's just work.
It is just work. And Nina has actually a great recent example of this in her portfolio.
Well, the first investment that I made in joining Canaan is a company called Tizona. And with one round of financing, their Series B financing, we brought three women onto the board in one fell swoop, myself and Shelley Chu from Abingworth and Jean George from Lightstone. And Pablo Cagnoni, the CEO, is a very diversity-oriented executive. He believes a lot in developing people. And he wouldn't say that it was by design to diversify his board, but it was a really happy coincidence. He also has a management team that's half female. And so we were sitting in the boardroom the other day. The board is seven members, and one of the male members of the board wasn't there that day. And a female observer to the board was present. So with a half membership of the management team and the balance of the board, we had a room full that was more women than men. For the first time, I think I've experienced that outside of my not-for-profit days or board. And it was just – it was a really charming realization. It was subtle, but it was definitely unique.
Things have shifted significantly.
Yeah.
And I think people need to understand that when a venture capital fund makes an investment, frequently they get a board seat, if not more than one board seat.
We generally take a board seat with every investment we make. So when you see the women at Canaan as part of the investment decision making, you are like 50% likely to get a woman on your board. How's that for odds?
Yes. Come on down. We got the women. Yeah.
Now, at the end of the day, though, this is still venture capital. We had a discussion last year, Julie, about the kinds of things that Canaan is looking for in the healthcare. You want to kick off the kinds of things you guys are looking for?
Sure. I think at a highest level, we're looking for therapies, products, and services that really impact clinical care and the outcomes for patients. And the majority of our investments are in pharmaceutical investments. So we look at new types of antibiotics, new types of cancer therapies, you know, new types of drugs to help people with autoimmune disorders, you know, areas where we have friends and family and others we know that really need more out of their products and services. But we also have been expanding in digital health, which is extremely exciting. You know, how can IT and new services enhance the experience for patients as well as clinicians?
And that's a really nice play, too, on diversification to riff on that point, because Canaan is a healthcare fund, but also we invest in tech. We're commingled under one fund. And when we're looking at digital health, it gives us an opportunity to work with our partners in the IT practice, looking at big data solutions, digital sensors and wired technologies. And so it's a great cross-pollinization.
I would say one of our biggest points of focus is we invest early stage. We invest in companies that maybe haven't tested a product into the clinic yet. And so we'll take entrepreneurs and spin a program out of a pharma company that's been shelved or spin a drug out of an academic institution, and we'll try to recruit a management team of top notch around that. And in fact, we did that recently with a program for an antiviral therapeutic out of UC San Diego. And it was a very academic team. And we recruited a female CEO to run that company, Gail Medeiros.
And there, too, I think you have half the management team are women.
Yes, over half the management team. The chief medical officer is a woman. Our chief development officer is a man. And our VP of non-clinical is a woman.
There are two paths I'd like you guys to talk about, and we'll take sort of one in turn as the other, unless you want to put them together. They may be integrated. For some, what advice do you give to women who want to ultimately become venture capitalists versus what advice do you want to give to women who want to be startup entrepreneurs, who want to start something because they're actually inventing something or discovering something that could become a product?
Maybe I'll take the entrepreneur. I think general advice to any entrepreneur is stick with it. Really believe in yourself. Ask as many questions as you can. Don't take no for answers. Knock on doors for advice. Network relentlessly. Ask people to open doors for you in building your access and building your kind of insights onto the business. But tenacity really, really wins. No one's going to be a bigger cheerleader for yourself than yourself. So I think sticking with it.
I see that so differently than frequently women are encouraged to be. It's like you're supposed to say, how can I help you? Not, I need help. Can you help me get that help?
Yeah, I think it's really turning that advice on the table. Really think selfishly about what you need to take your business forward. Be very impatient, gracious, but impatient about seeking advice and input. because it really takes that kind of tireless determination to couple to. I'm assuming that you have an expertise and a credibility and you have some insight and a justification for pursuing the idea that you're pursuing, but really seek to build the support around you and be tireless in pursuing that.
And if you want to become a venture capitalist, what's the advice there?
So I like to give recent graduates from business school or for scientific programs is the type of advice is there are very few venture capital openings. So you may have a great fit with a firm that you can get a foothold in, but really the most important thing is to get meaningful experiences with great teams and great companies in an area that you're quite interested in the new technology. So maybe it's biopharmaceuticals, maybe it's med tech, but go to work for a company that's actually innovating and be a part of that management team to really produce and understand what it means to achieve milestones within a company. That experience you can take to the bank every time. And when the opportunities arise in venture capital, if you're well-networked in the entrepreneurial community and you're well-networked in the venture community, you can hear about those opportunities and migrate over. Julie was very unusual when she came to us out of Stanford Business School with her MBA. She had 6 years of very meaningful career development at Genentech. She had achieved a lot while she had been there. She had held numerous positions. She had worked on very important drugs that had progressed through the clinic. So she came with very meaningful experiences where when she started working with startups, she had something to bring to the party.
She understood that biotech ecosystem. And I think having that as a reference point, understanding how these companies grow and build, what some of the challenges are, what some of the bureaucracies are, how decisions are made in pipelines and business development, that all, I think, gets gestated as an innate confidence. And you can see that in how she interacts with entrepreneurs and how she comports herself in the business. I think it's great advice.
We've been doing this over 20 years. It's the first time we ever talked about somebody who was in the room while we were talking about him. So
there we go.
It's a good thing because I'm blushing.
So Julie, what do
you give? Thank you,
radio. Julie, what kind of advice do you give the recent wannabe venture capitalist now that you've been in the business 2 years?
Yeah, it's a great question. I actually tell all my friends to try. I actually think there's a lot of really qualified women who don't put their name in or don't ask for the second degree connection like Nina said. I know a lot of qualified women, and I know a lot of qualified women with 2 graduate degrees and relevant experience and may not know anyone at a venture capital firm. I actually feel like part of my job is to try and help those people make a connection. So I am forwarding resumes every week of qualified people, especially to firms where there aren't any women, because they want to hire women. They really do. And then sometimes they just don't have them in their network. So I guess my recommendation is try and get into that circle, try and get into that network that Wendy referred to of entrepreneurs and VCs, because they know the people who can hire. And without those relationships, you can't get the job.
Well, I recently spoke with Sharon Wostek of Astia, which does a lot of women support and women venture capital investing in women's firms. And she said, it's that they can't see you. So you need to work out things so that you can be seen. And that advice applies to anyone. If for some reason they can't see you, you've got to get seen. And part of that is the networking and any number of things, you know. So I can understand it. And I definitely relate to the part that says you've got to go get some experience, because you're investing in propositions. You have to know something about how companies work in that area and what's a successful team and what isn't, and who's a successful manager and who isn't. It's not that you're sitting here just giving money away that sounds good. You actually do a lot more in-depth analysis. And it's not like you give the money away and start looking for other people. You're with that company. You're bound.
Absolutely. And I think in the days of LinkedIn, it's easy for people to say, well, what does venture capital really bring except for money? Where are those contacts that I can't get by going online? And I think it is from that time building a pattern recognition set and being able to reference those past business plans, those past challenges with regulatory, with a commercial issue, dealing with people dynamics day in and day out as a director, as an investor, builds a certain set that you can't quite get from an online portal search.
And the earlier you go in the phases of building a company, the more you have to be on the front lines of really a lot of the executive recruiting. And that's an area where networks really matter. Are you able to plug in to the right people to recruit the right teams? And are you able to network and get the real references on the teams? And so that recruiting process early days that builds the fabric of a company is incredibly important. And even if you can take one of the CEOs we backed in Chrono Therapeutics, Alan Levy, he's a 5-time CEO. We brought to bear 3 of his executive recruits through our network when he needed a CFO, when he needed a chief development officer. We made those important introductions, and that's where experience really matters. We're really proud at Canaan of the 13 female CEOs in our portfolio, and we have back 25 co-founders in our portfolio. We're really proud of those statistics.
I would also just say it's been a privilege to work with so many senior women, and it is an apprentice business in as they talk about the network, but it's also about, as Nina mentioned, seeing the patterns. I talk to a lot of women who are the only female in a fund. They are so jealous. And I have to say, I believe it's going to change. I really believe that. And we've already seen it in the last decade, and it's going to continue to accelerate.
When I joined Canaan, I had some other opportunities that I could choose from. So, and I didn't go looking for a firm that had a lot of other women, because if I did, I would have found a very short list. But it is something that was a really compelling factor and is more wonderful than I even expected now that I'm in the gang. But I think that's one of the things that we really have at Canaan as a platform, to be unabashed about advocating for other women. I no longer feel any hesitation in a board search to say we're going to make it a priority to find a woman for this slot. I question when there's a list of candidates for an executive position that doesn't include a number of women, because they're out there. We just need to be advocating, and I feel really proud and confident to do that, because it's very much part of the Canaan brand.
Wendy, you've been the venture capitalist the longest here with Canaan. We're going to give you the very last word.
The most interesting tagline from January, when there was a big blow up at the JP Morgan conference over whether women could be found in boards and executive positions and in venture capital. And my last word is, they're out there. All we need to do is try harder.
Well, great. I appreciate it. You guys come back. See me anytime. I want to hear all of your experiences and all of your success. You're always welcome in Biotech Nation.
Thank you so much.
My guests today are venture capitalists from Canaan Partners, General Partner Wendy Hutton, General Partner Nina Shelson, and Principal Julie Papanek. More information about Canaan Partners may be found on the web at canaan.com. That's Canaan, C-A-N-A-A-N, canaan.com. The first installment of our 2-part series on women in biotech venture capital is available online at iTunes and other podcast syndication outlets. For Biotech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment Biotech Nation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Muller, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Landcor. Thank you.